It is time to begin. We're in the midst of our winter section here. I do appreciate you coming out on these cold nights. I do appreciate it. The numbers dwindle. It concerns me, but I know that everybody else is going to pick it up online later, which is okay. That's all right, too, but I'd like to have you here if you can be. And if I'm boring you, you don't have to come. I guess that's true, so try to not do that for you. Maybe a comment about the lessons. You all know I didn't go to seminary and learn all the stuff, and I come back to tell you what I learned in seminary. I have to tell you what I learned in my adult life. And a lot of that is pretty new. Some of it's pretty fresh. Some of it's last week. A lot of it's last week, because I study every week for my lessons, and I'm sometimes only 1 week from extinction. So I have, my mind tends to think linear, which Occidental people do from the West. You think this, then this, then this, then this. And that works really good if we're 100 years ago or in the 17th century, 16th century, because we have a very clear order of what happened and what the important things were and, you know, like what order they happened in, right? So now I'm in a spot where I can't do that. I told you before in the beginning of our lesson that we're going to have a hard time describing the forest because we're standing so close to the trees and we don't know which tree is important, which one is just a shrub will die in a few years, or which little twig is going to grow up into a massive oak. So we have a little bit of a delicate difficulty with that. So without thinking about it, this is how I am doing it without thinking about it, is that we're dealing with the period of our time almost thematically or by subject rather than in a linear manner. It is impossible for me to do it linear. I decided that's what I've been struggling with. How do I get this so it all falls into place? So we have, you know, 1970, then we have 1980, then 1985. I can't do it. Because it's too much overlap. And this, you're going to see this today, and our lesson is going to be an overlap because we're going to do a lot of stuff that goes back even to the 19th century, and it carries way over into the 20th century. And so I want to just explain to you so that I don't feel guilty when I'm doing it by themes, because that's what we're doing. So pick a subject or a person or an event and kind of follow it along this whole period. And so when we're all done, we'll have these stacked up like books with bookends, and then you'll have the whole thing. And maybe at that point, we can maybe put together some kind of order of events that are important. And the closer we get to our time, the more difficult it is to do this linearly, because if I'd ask you what's the important event that happened today, I don't know that you could tell me. I surely couldn't. And in 2 years, we'd not be able to either. So anyway, that's what I'm saying. We need a little bit of perspective on this. So the closer it gets to our time, 2020, the more difficult it is to put things in logical order and which is important, which is not important. So that's what we're doing. On the board, I guess maybe one of the takeaways for me is, I guess maybe I don't know that I thought about this before or not. It's kind of like reading a book. I read this book back in whatever year it was when I probably got it. This is probably written 1978. I don't know, somewhere. I usually write down when I read it. And now I'm reading it again. It's like I never read it before. And the reason that is, you learn things about the history, and then all of a sudden you see things you didn't know was important, and all of a sudden, oh, that's that, where that fits, and so that's where that person fits, or that's what that event's. I never thought about that. So it almost becomes another book to read. So don't hesitate reading a book a second time, because it will probably get more out of it than the first time. Okay, so today's lesson is going to be a slice of history, not like this. It's going to be, not like this, but a slice of history, like a loaf of bread slice. And next week, we're going to try to move on a little bit, but I'm not going to guarantee, but we're going to move on a little bit further where I'm really got in my mind where we're heading. But all this stuff somewhat is background for what we're doing, which will get us more to our time, maybe in the last 40 years. So this week, we are in the third of our series, Our Time. It is said that we are the product of what we eat. Some of us more than less. It is also true that we are a product of history. not in the absolute sense, but that the history we make is related to the history we inherit. My parents were married in the Depression, and those memories had an impact on all their life choices. I lived with them. I heard about them, but I never experienced them. It was with a dismissive comment that, when I was 28, that I bought my first car, Dad said to me, now you can do what you want. Sort of looking at me and saying, why'd you buy that car? I think he was reminding me that he bought his first car when he was 39, so I was beating him 11 years. I could have picked another subject, you know, anything would have worked here, but I know about cars and dates and birthdays, so I could figure that one out pretty easily. So we're not materialists, on the other hand, materialists, that we are the product of our culture. But history doesn't form us, or at least ought to, about the choices we make. In other words, we often say, well, I won't do that again, because we know history. So the scheme in these lessons, we are dealing with issues that led us to our time, say 1950. It has become abundantly clear that in every theological issue we encounter, we bump into the death, burial, resurrection gospel. I might just say the gospel. When I say the gospel, I don't know, unless it be a very unusual context, I'm always going to mean the death, burial, resurrection of Jesus Christ's gospel, as narrowly defined in the historical theological event of the death and burial of Jesus Christ. So the root of evangel is simply good news, and the context fills in what good news is all about. But the way I use it in our discussions, it's usually about the death, burial, resurrection of Christ. Since it appeared that all significant theological controversies start with a confusion about the gospel, we must investigate it for our time. And I put on the board somewhat whether I figured out for the first time or reviewed it again, but the death, burial, resurrection gospel and inerrancy are paired together. Whenever they divide, we're going to have a difficulty. When inerrancy goes, the gospel goes. When the gospel goes, inerrancy goes. So they ride together. Okay, so that is even, and if the death, burial, resurrection gospel loses its standing before time, where did it happen? Well, we are considering a Christian America, not the world, just a Christian America, limited to that scope, but it's appropriate since America was the leader of missionary work in the great century of the great 19th century. It was surprising that in the 19th century, in spite of the great shift in theology to autonomous man from God's sovereignty, Calvinism, to Arminianism, it was the greatest missionary sending century ever. And I've often wondered, was it because it turned Arminian? Because they felt more responsible? I don't know. But it's true. Regardless, that there were two adverse winds blowing. In spite of these winds, it still was the greatest missionary century of all times. The adverse winds were, first of all, the French Revolution. It birthed ideas of postmillennialism. With it came political revolutions. We had one in France, one in our own country. The vast discoveries of science and the sciences that made life easier and explained things allowed it to, a lot of the things that we thought were mysteries were explained by science, therefore somewhat didn't need God. And we had advancements of technology, transportation, and communications all happened in the 18th century. And that movement of the French Revolution, the movement that came out of the French Revolution was an easy sell. It's a good time to be. When we went through that a few months ago, we said this is the greatest time to be alive, would have been the 18th century. The changes were immense when you talk about today, but the real changes really came in that century. What we got now is something more convenient, like an iPhone. Secondly, Finney's New Measures, borrowed from Schleiermacher in Germany, was an emotional Christianity, avoided the death, burial, resurrection, made it a moral reformation movement. So this new way of doing Christianity was done, and it was called the New Evangelical, New Evangelical. Not the Neo, that comes later, but again, it's interesting to use the word New Evangelical here. What were these reforms? Well, the world must prepare for the coming of the Messianic Age by starting a Christian millennium or age. Christ would come post-millennial after this Christian kingdom, Christian age, then Christ would come. So the moral reforms were necessary, such as cleansing the world, were held to be the abolition of slavery, the, up to the giving women the right to vote, and everything in between, I suppose. But in spite of the incoming flak exploding all around, the gospel definition held its ground at last week. Here, I suppose, is a surprise. While the American church was busy reforming cultural morals, the missionaries, likely sent out from an evangelical concern for the lost, continued to preach the gospel to the lost, providing eternal salvation by faith in the person and work of Jesus Christ. That seemed to be consistent. But back home, the gospel was being attacked by the leading pulpits, such as that of Henry Ward Beecher and Phillips Brooks and others. So how do we sort out what is good in these crosswinds that seem to be increasing in the later 19th century? Well, it's a matter of surprise, to me at least, that we can be informed by looking at the missionary activity. Why missionary activity? Why not a church? Well, if you follow the Methodist or the Presbyterians or the Congregationalists or any other group, we would find about them, but we wouldn't have a picture in the large sense. So nothing that represent all of them. So if you remember, the missionary conference did not focus on doctrinal issues. That would divide, and nothing could be accomplished. So they set aside their doctrinal issues, came together, talked about evangelism. So the doctrines were set aside, except the greed to, need for, personal evangelism. And the death, burial, resurrection gospel found an agreement. The meetings had more to do with logistics than the content of the gospel, which was not in dispute. The third world needed the gospel by any standard, by any doctrine. So the missionary conference gives us a consensus of the churches represented, which was most of them. Again, the priority of missionary work was to share divine truth so that the heathen would be saved. It was a human thing to show compassion and show life could be better with Western ideas, but they were by and large byproducts and of the proximity of the Western person in the third world culture. So anybody could do it. It wasn't a Christian could do this. Anybody could go to the places and show them how to do certain things. So it wasn't a Christian thing as such, but they brought those ideas with them. That the quality of life improved with the coming of a missionary is not in dispute, but the missionaries did not go to improve their lives. It was a byproduct, unprogrammed. Now, I remember this. I remember you told me this, but it was quite a while ago. Someone told me that women do better in this regard than men on the mission field. Now, I can very much identify with this. The women are not usually prone to innovate to make life easier. They might think they are, but they aren't. We'll spend their time doing missionary work rather than improve life. In my home, I work at my computers, and my wife keeps asking me, why am I doing this? Are you following this argument? All right. I'm making my life better. She'd understand how that could be. For example, women were content to carry water from the well, but the men were trying to bring running water to the house. The men failed in carrying out on missionary activity to that extent. If I'd be there, I'd try to... You mean you got to carry the water all the way? I'm going to fix you up in a pipe. I'm going to make it out of wood. It's going to come into your house. And you'd have to go and get the water, you know. And the wife says, why you do that? I can get water myself. So it takes discipline to avoid those things and do missionary work. Surely life with running water is better than carrying it. But missionaries were not sent to build water systems. And I'll say later, they didn't send plumbers. Yet, advice by men and women to separate out sewage from fresh water will save physical lives. So wisdom is needed here so that it does not overturn their missionary or missions contributions. You can see there's a fuzzy line there. It is highly unlikely that Paul advised any about water, better health, or increased efficiencies, but then he went without the knowledge of them. Kind of a clue right there. Perhaps we have sent too many with too many conveniences to be effective. The later missionaries failed this. They took everything with them, their schools, their doctors, you know, the campers, whatever. And they didn't fit very well in the mission field and so forth. They had a hard time getting a hearing. Now, that's kind of later, not earlier. So it's often wondered about this. And some of those people, like the Master's College, Master's Seminary, I think this is probably how they do this. They train men And when you graduate, they give them a diploma or whatever, you get a degree, and you go out and you're on your own. They have no church planting ministry. Maybe that's a good thing, because if you have a degree, you ought to be able to go out and plant your own church, right? So better go plant a church with nothing but a week's worth of rent. It might make you a little more honest about what you're doing, right? Then, well, I've got 6 weeks, 6 months of salary, maybe 3 weeks of support, and we've done it that way. And the end of 2 weeks or three, I'm sorry, at the end of 2 years, nothing more than we had than before we started. Maybe we should just let them go on their own. Maybe we would have figured out a way to do it, like a missionary would have to if they went out there without anything with them, rather than bring all the stuff with them. Another story, but you understand what I'm saying here. They went out there as missionaries to share the gospel. And if you're going to do that, you got to leave all the other stuff behind, or you're not going to be very effective. So living like the people will more likely have them believe your message. This certainly is a question that confronts us in the 21st century missionary. And by the way, that's quite much different than in the 19th century. Well, back to our subject. It was shown that up to 1900, the Conference on Evangelism in New York, that there was a consensus on the meaning and value of the death, burial, resurrection, of Christ on behalf of sinners, and it sort of became a benchmark. You could talk about before 1900, and you talk about after 1900. Now, we talked about David Wells last week. We're going to use him again today. Using David Wells' definition of a movement, the evangelicals, that is within the larger church, was a movement, I say, until the 1900s, at least the 1910. As we will see that in the 1910 Edinburgh change, that had changed. The death, burial, and resurrection was no longer the center of evangelical endeavor, but with the ideas of social change or improvements, it finally overwhelmed the evangelical movement in the larger church and swamped it, flipped it, and made making lives better rather than converting souls from death to life the issue. So metaphorically, they began to send plumbers rather than evangelists. To complicate this, after 1910, especially in Jerusalem, in 1928, a conference, an inclusive Christianity was made it impossible to send missionaries to Catholic countries because Catholics are now involved in this. So it's like sending people to a Catholic country would be saying, well, it's already been evangelized, the Catholics would say. So they don't need evangelism, so they got ruled out. By the way, if you notice this, we are following the liberal stream this time. We're not following the fundamentalists. We're following the liberal stream, okay? Which becomes an issue later. So the field of evangelism shrunk to a place where no Christian version ever existed. Of course, that makes the mission field a lot smaller. But then it was found that those religions in other places also had received some light from above. And syncretism, Christian ideals found in other religions, killed the necessity of sending missionaries there also. So, send in the plumbers. By the time of the forming of the National Association of the Evangelicals in 1942, there was no need for old-fashioned missionary activity. Again, we're talking about from a liberal standpoint. Conservatives were sending missionaries up, but the liberals were not. At least not the old kind DBR stuff. So speaking of the old-fashioned gospel, it was not accidental that Charles Fuller, I think in 1933, picked those pejorative words to name his to-be worldwide radio program, the Old-Fashioned Revival Hour. This was a direct pushback on the statement of the social gospelizers that the gospel was old-fashioned. Without any political correct sensitivity, without a spirit of let's get along, he names it exactly what it was denied and had a wonderfully fruitful ministry from 25 to 1968. By the way, Fuller becomes a problem, but not in the beginning. He was a dispensationalist and got somewhat tricked. So 1993, when Wells wrote his book, some 80 years later, the gospel was stripped from the evangelicalism. David Wells says that the evangelicals have no center, and I say again, as the church lost its evangelical center in the space of 10 years and not up to 1910, the fundamentalist evangelicals reclaimed the center. Now, the conservative side here, the fundamentalists, the evangelicals, reclaimed the center from 1910 to 1974, but then lost it again at the Lausanne Conference, and that's something maybe we'll talk about next week. I think it'll work, should be next week. It is of those who were losing the gospel from the NAE on, Duell Steim, that made his remark true, at least for the Reformed Church. Now, again, I have to make a distinction. What I'm saying about the gospel, the arguments so far that go forth and back and forth, these largely refer to the Reformed Church. The dispensation churches were not affected by this deviancy. They fairly well followed the line here. They stayed together. Evangelical evangelism and inerrancy stayed together. Not so with the Reformed Church. What is true is that the covenantalists are the ones who promise a gospel to change the world. That's the flaw. They promise a gospel to change the world by some kind of kingdom ideology or other, and that changes. So they have a flawed foundation at the beginning, and I've showed you my slope curve, and they're sitting on that curve trying to hang on with their life so they don't slide clear down to the kingdom only now position, which we are going now with the modern people, young kids that we have, that are out there praising the Lord, whatever they're doing with their time, following Piper and other people. So they sit on the slope, reformers sit on the slope in time they will slide to the full social gospel. There's nothing to stop this except the literal word from God, which they have denied. So what is to keep them perched? Absolutely nothing. And time and again, they keep on sliding down, unless they die first. Well, David Wells said, evangelicals, speaking, he's a reformed guy himself, were never a movement because they did not have a direction. 1993, he writes, after 1974, after they have lost direction. Wells may have lost direction, means they lost the gospel. Wells may have been right in defining a movement, but even by his definition that we saw last week, the evangelicals, fundamentalists, did indeed have a direction. In the 1900, there was a united understanding that the one thing that held evangelicals together, in spite of the various differences in theology, was that they all agreed to what the mission of the church was in the world, the unevangelized world. It was in a verb that becomes a noun. To evangelize is to become an evangelical. They agreed on that. So Wells was wrong. The evangelicals had a unifying purpose. It was simply that Wells did not like what evangelicals were unified around. We were unified around the gospel, and he was unified around changing the world. His covenantalism was kowtowing to the modernist ideas of social concerns, borrowed from Finney, from which brought them liberalism early in the 20th century, the introduction of social concerns. The fundamentalists rejected the social concerns, were indeed the gospel, rejected that, and that was called the Great Reversal. Yet Wells, with jaundiced eyes, was looking over the fence to the liberals, concerned for the whole man, caved in. It's like a cow reaching for greener grass, pulls down the fence. Wells wakes up, finding himself in a different pasture, now begins to criticize those who have not followed him, to wit, evangelism cannot be the movement center. I can't imagine why he cannot say that. Yet he gives credit to Carl Henry for his effort. He says, despite the best efforts by such leaders as Carl Henry in the early years of its current growth to provide one, Henry, he says, tried to do that, but didn't work. So now is a good time to talk about the very idea of success. He says that Henry tried to give the evangelicals a center for their movement, but despite his best efforts, did not. Well, we wonder who was to blame. Well, the Uneasy Conscience book is still in print for nearly 50 years, widely read, and no results. David Wells, do we say a failure? Henry was one of the most respected theologians, wrote that book, Uneasy Conscience, of the 20th century, could hardly have done more. And I have his book somewhere here. This is his biography, quite large, and it's page after page after page after page where he did what he did, where he went, who he spoke to, what he spoke on, and it sounded like tiring. So his memoirs are exhausting to read of all the places, the countries, institutions, board membership he held, where he taught what papers he wrote, what books he wrote, what times he had to write. In some ways, very influenced, influential. Perhaps we could acknowledge a few results after all of this work. We have Robert Schuller dealt with flagging self-esteem. Bill Hybels followed Schuller's easy, non-offensive Christianity, entertaining the goats, Spurgeon would have said, instead of feeding the sheep. Rick Warren stamped out AIDS in Africa and poverty elsewhere. Yet the time since 1947 to 1993, the influence pervasiveness of Western Christianity has fallen at an unprecedented rate. No wonder he sees it a failure. So as these feeble and misguided efforts increased, there came, as well said, no more place for truth. Brian McLaren, an evangelical, states that the death, burial, and resurrection of Christ, if done by the Father, was child abuse. McLaren kept his credentials. He is an evangelical. His books continue to be high demand. There must be only a slight difference between a hero and a heretic. That evangelicals have an identity crisis beginning with Henry in 1947 was made official in 1974. Wells recognizes this. Mark Knoll, we had him about a year ago in our class here. Not him, his book. Mark Knoll, the theologian of covenantalism, writes his revealing book, In Search of Christian America. And in the book, he still doesn't know what it is. He doesn't know what the place of the church is in America to change culture. He does not have an answer. After nearly 2,000 years of covenantalism, still have not figured out the cultural role of the church. The flaw is not recognized what the church's job actually is. It is evangelism, folks. Otherwise, the Lord would take us home, not reversing God's judgments in the garden. Well, briefly back to Henry in his Confessions of a Theologian, which is the name of the book, he attempts to make some recommendations for evangelicals. He says, this is what went wrong. In a 25-page critique, he lays out his case for the opportunities lost that he did everything humanly possible to avoid. But there just was no cooperation from the fundamentalists. They just made it worse. She says, I have two main convictions about the near-term future of American Christianity. One is that American evangelicals presently face the biggest opportunity since the Protestant Reformation, if not since the Apostolic Age. The other is Americans are forfeiting the opportunity stage by stage. So the saddest side of this forfeiture is that many evangelical leaders bask. I don't know what he means. I should probably skip this last one because I don't even know what he means by it. The saddest state of this forfeiture is that many evangelical leaders bask promotionally in the movement's towering success instead of pointing it to repentance, rededication, reformation, and renewal. Worse yet, even some so-called renewal movements have promotive and exploitive facets. I guess it's all about themselves. I suppose that's what he's saying. And then I thought, well, it's hard to know exactly who he's talking about since that was 1987, since the really big offenders came after his writing. The big ones came after his writing. Whatever Henry's option is, he never expresses regrets for opening the door to social involvement. I do not believe that it even occurred to him. Trained in liberal or leaning liberal schools, he adopted the party line of a gospel for the whole man. Anything less is really not Christianity, he said. But wait, Henry does not. But wait, Henry does put his finger on the linchpin that began this unraveling of the evangelicals. What he suggests is that the evangelicals never could unify over the commonly held center. The whole social gospel, because they were caught up in the battle for inerrancy. If we'd give up the battle for inerrancy, we could unify ourselves on the social gospel. Remember why I said this over here, to go together? Now, this is a strange turn of events to me. Henry breathlessly defends his orthodox view of inerrancy, and he does, and I believe he is an inerrancy guy. He wrote his theology, a long two-volume book on God, revelation, and authority, God who speaks and knows, on the basis of the authority of the inerrant word. Without that, all is lost, and Christianity is no better than or worse than the next. That's Henry. The reveal of God is essential and cannot be ignored. That's Henry. Yet it is here that Henry falters or disagrees with the fundamentalist, not in substance, but in priority. Henry argues that the fundamentalists made inerrancy the gateway or the first essential to be maintained. Henry argues that inerrancy is absolutely necessary, but is not the first issue, nor ought it be the dividing issue between brothers. Conciliation at this point would preserve the unity and various forms of inerrancy. I like that. Forms of inerrancy. In other words, forms of authority, could be argued within the family. As it was, the fundamentalists saw inerrancy as a test of faith and drew everyone out of the fundamentalist camp who were not in agreement. According to Henry, this was an overreach. The fundamentalists were too restrictive. They caused the breach of faith and offended the evangelicals. These were likely dispensationalists to a person. So Henry laments that at the peak of the evangelical influence, 1976, Newsweek cover page, Year of the Evangelical, the inerrancy debate complicated the discussion of authority. The inerrancy debate complicates the discussion of authority. Are you following that mixed statement? Francis Schaeffer was on the right side, predicted a layman's inerrancy movement, yet many of Southern Baptists were put off by inerrancy. This insistence of an inerrant authority spread to the schools, and the fundamentalists, and the fundamentalists, by insisting on inerrancy, compromised the evangelical schools and seminaries. And I suppose Henry means in the wrong direction. In other words, the fundamentalists forced inerrancy on these schools and taught nothing else. Remember, he said with two phrases, one out of his mouth, you got to stand for it. The other said, we don't need to stand for it completely. Which is it then? So Henry makes clear that the left holds no answer to the social problems. And we found, as found in Jim Walsh, who's still around, and Ron Sider, who's still around, and socialism. These are now the what we call the Christian Marxists. This left side of the movement had turned to the peace movement and nuclear disarmament already in the 1970s and 80s. Further, the leftists were blaming the rich Christians and capitalists for world poverty, the emergence of Christian Marxism already back then. He criticizes Jerry Falwell's moral majority, Liddy's short-lived fire that fizzled, but no one ever believed that it would change America into a Christian something. Yet Henry could rightly criticize the moral majority for a socially misdirected effort. And I asked, now, Henry, which is it? Some of these tried. So it seems that Henry had a good sense of knowing what is true. He just wanted it done perfectly in his imagined world. With the fundamentalists giving in to buy time for those weak on inerrancy to adjust and join them. And I say, well, how good a chance would that be? So the fundamentalists were right. A nose in the tent guarantees that Campbell will be sleeping in your bed before sunset. Henry strongly suggests that the point is not that Scripture's comprehensive reliability is not an important issue. It is, he remarks. But scriptural integrity, now watch this. Scriptural integrity, the argument, is nullified if spokesmen for scriptural inerrancy combine it with perverse misjudgment and distortions of other views. That's kind of dangerous, but so when inerrantists accuse others of being in error, reading the scripture, their voice is silenced because they criticize others for allowing an inerrant scripture. So if you're silent, you allow the other side to gain ground. They cannot be silent. So as expected, Henry is held responsible for a soft view of inerrancy by people that are like us. I read his book. I explained to you what he is like accurately. So Henry is held responsible for a soft view of inerrancy, but as a person, he did understand that without an inerrant authority, there is no authority. Why did Henry not see the trap door that would trip up the evangelicals if not secured? The fundamentalists secured the dangerous pitfall and pointed out wherever it was found. Henry thought they should have been more patient or quietly written scholarly papers that no one would read. If the fundies would have, they could have saved the evangelical movement. I doubt it. But who am I? Well, we have gotten ahead of the story, but yet we're not really ahead of anything. Go see the end coming, helps us understand it, the simple pitfalls that led to the disaster later on. Last week, we established that up until 1900, evangelicals understood that evangelicalism was singularly promoting the death, burial, resurrection of Christ as the basis for saving faith. That it was saving faith that was the center of all missionary efforts for the evangelicals. Of course, ever since Finney, Christianity was being redefined as moralism, but when missionaries were sent out in the great century for Christianity, they carried the death, burial, resurrection gospel to the darkest places of the world. If there was, in these endeavors, an exportation of a Western culture, I come back to this, it was incidental and below the purpose of those who were sending and those who were sent. We could suggest the same phenomenon in the British colonization of India. They did not go there to establish the English language, but going there, India, by the British, made the English language inevitable. And in the long run, a great benefit. As a byproduct of colonialism, countries were made conversant in an international language and for economics and education, and of course, Christian literature, great benefit. So if Western culture spread to these countries, it happened as a byproduct and in many places greatly welcomed. But the death, burial, and resurrection gospel was the focus of all missions. However imperfect, there were two objectives. It was popular in that time, talking about from the French Revolution on, it was popular in that time, the developing of the postmillennialism, ideas of the coming of Christ. Some were content to save souls for the coming kingdom as a growing dispensational hope that was growing, eventually would reach nearly 100%. The rest were saving souls to make the world a better place, though evangelized souls, producing moral ones. But they all wanted to evangelize the soul. Enough of these would rush in the kingdom, the most millennialists would say, and this would predate the coming of the Lord in his second coming. It's like post-millennialism. There was an agreement on that, even though the theology is quite different. When no one seriously questions the evangelical stance of the missionary movement of the 19th century, is known to be the biblical doctrine, it was known to be biblical doctrine, godly in conduct, emphasized personal reconciliation with God, and concern for the human and national welfare. But trending, while the church in some countries was adversely influenced by Socinianism, that's Unitarianism, rationalism, Darwin, evolutionism, and finally modernism and humanism, these forces allied with the cause of world evangelization had their moorings in the authority and the fallibility of Scripture. The result was the great century of world missions. If you ever have interest in this subject in more detail, I would really recommend that book, Battle for World Evangelism by Johnston. He was a teacher at the Trinity Seminary in Deerfield, Illinois for years. Okay, I need a break. And my break is, I don't know how to proceed here because I've got a bunch of stuff I already left out. So what I was going to do for you is try to read some headlines. We want to look at what the root causes were. Root cause, I'm going to give you some headlines rather than read all these panels because we do not have time. And I'm not sure you're really interested. It starts out with the YMCA. Remember the time of Moody? YMCA was formed in London. And when Moody came to Chicago, YMCA is where he camped out and where he made his ministry from. At that time, it was really relatively conservative group yet. But there were people that didn't trust it because of all the heresies of the 1940s. So they asked for a statement of faith. And this is the statement of faith that came out in 1869. I'm not going to read it because it's just like we could read. There's nothing wrong with it. I'm not probably wrong high on eschatology, but as far as soteriology, it's fine. It's good. So that was then. And now we move closer and closer to the 19th century. So as long as Moody was around, apparently that statement of faith pretty well stood. Now, remember, statement of faiths are a snapshot in time, and that people that live under statement of faith don't have to believe it. And that apparently became the case, as sometimes we have, even with men in seminary, they don't believe the statement of faith that they've subscribed to. But that's not a problem for them because they have no conscience. So then we have this Edinburgh period where we come to 1910, and things seem to be changing. We have an epoch-making conference, and it became exclusive in its nature, and that the roots of that exclusiveness was in the YMCA. And by the way, it was from the young leadership. I've said this before. I know all of you guys are not young, but it's through the young people that some of this stuff has come. And I guess it's, I find it difficult personally to criticize a young person who's interested, but he's if off track, he needs to be helped back on track. But sometimes young people will not take it because, as all sophomores know everything, but yet they know nothing and no one there to correct them. It goes on to worse things. So we have this going on. Now, this interesting statement here, this is something that I would never have said, but I'm not really a historian. I just read books about history. It says, great changes became evident in the period between 1900 and 1910 were far more critical in shaping the Christian church than those decades which accumulated in the Peace of Augsburg and the Treaty of Westphalia. Now, I'm going to ask you, anybody know what those treaties mean? I'll tell you. Look at the date, 1555. The Peace of Augsburg was a peace agreement between the Catholics and the Protestants that allowed each other legitimacy. In other words, they can both actually live. Doesn't mean they don't hate each other, but they recognize each other. You know, finally, you have to do that when you come to a stalemate. Now, this is during the time of the Jesuits. So that's a Peace of Augsburg. So it would allow people to have their religion, so to speak. The Treaty of Westphalia, that might be a little easier one. Anybody know about that one? Ever heard of the 30 Years' War? Probably heard about that one. My wife's been in my class. The end of the 30 Years' War is 1648, started in 1618, 30 years. What was settled then? Territories. The Treaty at Westphalia is that this is Protestant territory, and this is Catholic territory. Because of the 30-year wars, they were swapping back and forth, back and forth, and back and forth. In fact, you'll find that even Zwingli, a little bit before this, but he was caught in one of those wars over the Catholic Protestant territory. Now, Zwingli would have died in 1530, something like that. So 100 years before, but the wars just continued on. So they call it the 30 Years' War, 1618, 1648. The Treaty of Westphalia was settled there. All right. Remember, Johnson is saying here that what happened in Edinburgh in 1910 was bigger than the Peace at Augsburg and the Peace of Westphalia. Have you ever heard of that? I mean, you ever heard of what happened in Edinburgh? Edinburgh? No. So, but it was a big game changer for the Protestant church. Remember, we went from the gospel to social gospel. I don't even hate to call it a gospel. Social activism from the gospel in 1910. Now, that's why it's probably a big deal. That's why Johnson thinks it's a big deal. So that's when it was switched. I'm just going to page through for you. You've got 15 minutes left here. All right, page two. Then we flip that over. Social becomes the dominant, the evangelical. When it goes under, it disappears. There's no second place, you know. It doesn't happen. So the idea is to make the world a better place gospel. I've heard that before. So we have some more headlines. We have inerrancy and evangelism rise together. It's my drawing on the board. So literary criticism destroys the Bible. We even have form criticism. We have source criticism. And the Bible is not true unless it can be confirmed by some outside source. If it can't be confirmed from the outside source, like a miracle, then a miracle didn't happen. So that's literary criticism, and it destroyed the Bible. When you destroy the miraculous out of the Bible, the supernatural out of the Bible, you no longer have a supernatural Bible. You just have written Bible, the men. So with a vacuum now, experience is hard to be denied. This comes from Schleiermacher. Christianity is a feeling. We celebrate Christmas whether we have the Christ child in our mind or not. It's our feeling of Christmas. Then we have the scientific adopted instead of, you know, for absolutes. So experience is hard to deny, part of this. And the revived authority now, instead of being in the inerrant word, it's in the church, organized church. Now, in order to get into the right ballpark, you got to join the church. And that's where your salvation is found, especially through baptism and so forth. So now we have theological uncertainty. No one knows for sure. What do you expect? We got lost. We lost inerrancy. We just have a Bible that, you know, is authority in some way, but we don't know sure how. So we have a theological uncertainty about everything. And we go back to David's Wells statement again, now we're in search for truth again. So, the Bible is now just simply literature, has no authority. Individualism of all, inclusivism of all religions, as I said before, they made studies. They went out and they found that all the religions of the world had some moral value in it, and they assigned that value to coming from a heavenly light. So not only does Christianity have light, but all the other pagan religions have light too, so you can't deny them the gospel because we need to learn from each other. So therefore, you never want to destroy another culture because there's something of God in each one of these. So it's inclusivism of all religions. Now we're talking about after 1910, a social emphasis, the fatherhood of God of all beings. We all are children of God. We had that on our opening slide. And then we have that. We have the death of evangelism. If all this is true, there's no evangelism necessary because no one needs to be saved. They're somehow saved from what? And there's no need for a gospel of death, burial, resurrection of Christ. So with that, foreign missions ends. And there are good withdrawals of this time. The China Indian Mission withdraw, the Christian Missionary Alliance. We have churches withdraw, and we sort of see the split going on with the evangelicals from the main lines. And the broader of inclusive view of theology, like we've already talked about. Okay, syncretism, but all religions have something to contribute. So we come to the point of no return when the leaves fall off the trees. They don't ever go back, do they? So the entire theological debate was crystallized at Jerusalem in 1928 and received extensive treatment. As the gospel was being retained, as inertia fights being removed, once the gospel is loosened, it is a matter of inertia before it all but disappears. So we have in 1910 this pent-up joy, enthusiasm, the world is going to be fixed, everything's going to be great, we're going to have a Christian country, we're going to have a Christian world, and then the Lord's going to come back. That was the feeling out of 1910, generated an enthusiastic spirit of optimism toward the Christianization of the world. Each of the Christian colonial powers, whether Anglican, Protestant, Roman Catholic, would assume a responsibility for the evangelization of their colonial interests. The world would be evangelized and the coming kingdom of God would be ushered in. Post-millennial hopes, the organizational ability of the keenest minds applied to this endeavor would accomplish this goal perhaps during the lifetime of Edinburgh 910 delegates. They always want the keenest mind to figure this stuff out because they know they can't figure it out by just dumb people like us. So we got to get the really smart ones. Put them in a corner and they'll figure it out, just like Henry thought, just like Fuller thought, not Fuller, but the school thought. And so again, look for these keenest minds and put them to work on this. Well, we're still waiting. All right. For some, this meant that the benefits of Western civilization would be shared with the entire world. Remember, this is part of their evangelism now. It's now changed to social work. For the leaders of Edinburgh 1910, it meant the formation of national Christian councils in each country so that the missionaries and national church leaders would participate in this effort as a united body. The unity of the church would become the mightiest apologetic for world evangelism. The evangelization of the world by foreign missions would hasten the visible unit of the one visible Church of Christ in every non-Christian nation. It is difficult to imagine, then, the disillusionment that the discouragement that the outbreak of World War I brought to Christianity. Protestant Germany and Roman Catholic Italy were on one side against the Anglican England, Roman Catholic France and Belgium and Orthodox Russia on the other side. This is Christianity split right down the middle. In fact, the Catholic Church is split down the middle. This unchristian demonstration not only reduced the supply of Western missionaries, but also destroyed the common missionary cause of all Christian unity. So another generation sort of feebly limps into Jerusalem in 1928, began to look toward a Christ-like world based on the ethics of Jesus as the ideal of a Christianized world faded. Remember, it didn't go back to the death, burial, resurrection. We left that. This social political optimism has remained to dominate its thinking and action in the 1968 up till 1968 period. Without denying Christian responsibilities, evangelicals in this century have been considered pessimistic because of their general prophetic view of the political and social life will deteriorate until the return of Jesus Christ, who say, my kingdom is not of this world. And I said to myself, finally, somebody said it. So my conclusion, right on time. Nevertheless, the goal of biblical evangelism is not a Christianized world or a Christ-like world, but a faithful evangelization to whatever is God's intent. It will not happen until the tribulation. New York 1900 was evangelical in its historical sense of the word. Edinburgh 1910 was no longer evangelical, but ecumenical, upholding a pluralistic, progressive theology. After Edinburgh 1910, evangelism hesitated and faltered and almost died in the International Missions Council, Young People's Movement. Now, it is striking to me that Carl Henry, 1986, knowing about Johnson's book, 1978, he even cites from it, would not see the pattern set up in the 1910 conference, where the issue of inerrancy was the first to surface. He did not see that once inerrancy was set aside, all other challenges of the liberal modern church could not be denied. Yes, biblical inerrancy was held by Henry, but not held to the same point of attack. Luther said, if you do not engage the battle at the point of attack, you have not engaged the battle at all. And I've heard this repeated by Gill, and this has determined largely the issue to be addressed as a church. The time to address heresy is never an easy determination. The cost of delay cannot be recognized until the time to address it is too late. Well, we are privileged to stand and overview the wreckage of the last 100 years, see some good things, and have a good perspective on it. Our church has faithfully, more or less, addressed difficult issues. For that, we have been paid the price, expected price of a faithful servant. We now consider that slavery. We have not been perfect. We have not even got all the theology perfect. But there is in the heart of your leadership a desire to get it right. And so if not now, when? And if not us, who? So Carl Henry had ample opportunity in his position to remove the flag from the middle of the road where Billy Graham had planted it and move it to the right at God's inerrant word and let the chips fall where they may. But that takes courage. Instead, he tried very hard and skillfully to steer a middle course with Billy Graham in establishing Christianity today. He thought apparently that one can wait for the serious battle later after we've won back the erring. But I believe, as he said in the last words of his book, there must have been an inkling that he may have missed a turn somewhere, because he ends it in this prayer. Lord, get me safely home before it is dark.